Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, January 13th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Bells Ring Again at First Baptist to Mark 140th Anniversary, by B.K. Richter, staff writer. The bells at First Baptist Church of Midland were silent for three decades. Their bells are ringing again, just in time for a historic celebration. First Baptist is celebrating its 140th anniversary, and senior pastor Darren Wood said not only are the bells back, but the stained glass windows in its auditorium have also been replaced. Two other congregations in Midland have celebrated similar anniversaries. Our friends at First Presbyterian celebrated their 140th anniversary in December, Wood said. And our friends at First Methodist celebrated their 140th anniversary in September. All three churches were founded within 6 months of each other. First Baptist sent First Presbyterian and First Methodist flowers. They returned the warm gesture with their own gifts. The reason that we felt so strongly about commemorating it is that we really wanted people to reflect on the fact that God has carried us for 140 years, Wood said. A lot of organizations, a lot of churches, don't make it that long. Some of our staff and some of our church members told us to wait for 150 years. Well, I can see that, but there's no guarantee we'll be here in 10 years. On Sunday, January 11th, First Baptist planned to host a special Sunday service featuring former staff members. We have invited Mayor Lori Blong to our service, Wood said. State Senator Kevin Sparks grew up in our church. He will also be here to offer a kind word. So we have people who have been a part of us who have moved away for one reason or another. They are coming back. First Baptist is also digging into its archives. We are pulling items out of the archive rooms that people have forgotten about. We had a time capsule that we buried here in 1950. We opened it a few years ago, but we just stored it away, and now we are bringing it back out, Wood said. A Bible dating to 1894 is also part of the celebration. We will be using that on Sunday morning, and we have got some letters that have been sent to us from some of our friends in other places, elected leaders and such, Wood said. In all, the First Baptist congregation has been led by 21 pastors, including Wood. I am grateful for God's goodness to us, for the opportunity to serve this great family, he said. To be here together is no small thing. What brought me to Midland wasn't that I needed a job. I already had a great job, but it was the people that we encountered when we got here. That's what brought us here, and that's what keeps us here. For more information about the special service commemorating the 140th anniversary, visit the church's website. This article is entitled, 73% of Parents Considered School Switch. New survey's findings for 2025 are likely to repeat in the coming year. By Crystal Huggins, staff writer. As Texas rolls out a new education savings account program that could reshape how families pay for school, a new survey shows millions of parents are already weighing whether to move their children to different classrooms. Nearly 3 out of 4 Texas parents considered switching schools for at least one of their children last year. However, only about 1 in 4 ultimately made the leap, according to a survey released by the National School Choice Awareness Foundation, or NSCAF. Others said they ran out of time, struggled to find nearby options, or worried about disrupting a child's academic and social life. For many parents, the search began during major life or school transitions. About 1 in 5 parents said they started looking when a child entered school for the first time, while others began searching during school-level transitions or after moving to a new community. More than 1/3 of parents said dissatisfaction with their child's current school or a desire for a better fit also played a role. When evaluating options, parents focused heavily on school environment and quality. More than half said a safe, supportive setting was their top priority, followed by schools offering a specific educational approach and strong academics with high-quality teaching. Texas families have a growing range of education options, including traditional public schools, charter and magnet programs, private schools, online learning, and home-based or micro-school settings. Among parents who made a switch, choices varied widely, with families selecting homeschooling, charter schools, private schools, and full-time online programs. Families can use state money for private school tuition, transport, and other school costs through education savings accounts starting this year. Charter schools, online programs, and home-based options also offer families alternative routes, despite public school transfer policies varying by district. Thanks to the enactment of the Education Savings Account program, Texas families now have more education choices than at any time in the state's history, said Andrew Campanella, CEO of the NSCAF. Interest in exploring new options is expected to remain strong. A majority of Texas parents surveyed said they are likely to consider a new school for at least one of their children in the coming year as the ESA program comes online. Strong demand for school choice shows why programs like these, along with a robust charter sector and flexibility within traditional public schools, are essential. As the ESA comes online, we encourage families to start searching now, Campanella said. Early planning doesn't just help parents. It also gives schools time to hire teachers and expand capacity to meet demand. The findings are based on a January 2026 survey of 513 Texas parents conducted by the NSCAF. Starting February 4th, parents can submit applications for the Texas Education Freedom Accounts Program. The first awards will be available to participating children for the 2026-27 school year. National School Choice Week approaches later this month, running from January 25th to the 31st, offering Texas parents opportunities to learn more about their education options. More than 2,300 schools and organizations across the Lone Star State will host events and activities, such as school fairs, information sessions, open houses, and parent nights. For more information about National School Choice Week, visit schoolchoiceweek.com. This article is entitled "Big Spring Police Arrest Man for Murder After Fatal Shooting" by B.K. Richter, staff writer. Howard County. The Big Spring Police Department has reported the arrest of a man on an alleged murder charge. According to a press release obtained by the Reporter-Telegram, at approximately 10:32 p.m. January 9th, Big Spring officers were dispatched to the 2600 block of Langley Drive in reference to shots being fired at a residence. Officers stated they arrested Joel Adrian Flores, 43, who was standing outside the residence when officers arrived. The gunshot victim, identified as Philip Samuel Lozana Jr., 36, had allegedly forced his way into Flores's residence while being armed. Big Spring Police Department officers discovered that Lozano had suffered from gunshot wounds and was deceased, Big Spring Police said. Lozano was later pronounced deceased by Justice of the Peace Campbell. Big Spring Police Chief Chad Williams stated that probable cause arrested for a murder charge. Detectives subsequently obtained a murder arrest warrant for Flores, and he was arrested on January 10th. He has been booked into the Howard County Detention Center, where he is being held on a $1 million bond. This investigation is still ongoing, and there is no further information available at this time. This article is entitled, Carbon Management Plan Could Lead Texas to Economic Growth, by Mella McEwen, Oil Editor. Texas, already a national leader in energy production, could lead the nation in carbon management if it follows the Texas Carbon Management Roadmap, a comprehensive framework for carbon management. The advantage in Texas is it has the longest history of utilizing carbon dioxide, said Ryan Kammer, research manager of carbon management with Great Plains Institute, a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping develop pragmatic energy solutions. For Texas, this is tying into how it's had success and how to provide new opportunities, he told the Reporter Telegram. Carbon management is an emerging industry that could attract up to an estimated $150 billion in investment by 2050. Texas is uniquely poised with its combination of the nation's largest CO2 pipeline network, massive geological storage capacity, an energy workforce ready to scale, and industrial clusters in refining, petrochemicals, and steel for carbon capture integration. Developing the roadmap involved talking to more than 100 stakeholders across industry, government, environmental organizations, labor, community groups, and technical experts. This is what we heard from the state, Kammer said. There was a lot of interest in implementing the recommendations. He said those involved in developing the roadmap knew some of the recommendations could be implemented quickly, while others, primarily related to education of communities, policymakers, and regulators, would take more time. It's interesting to see the variety of people in the space, the communities that are active, he commented. With more than 850 industrial facilities and over 360 million metric tons of CO2 emitted annually, Texas has one of the strongest business cases for carbon management in the country. That means the foundation is there, and there are entities familiar with carbon management, Kammer said. He noted that it could also open significant new opportunities for Texas businesses from international markets seeking low-carbon energy. This article is entitled, City Council to Open 2026 with Busy Agenda, by Luke Diaz, staff writer. Midland City Council will host its first meeting of 2026 on January 13th. This will also be the first meeting of the new terms for Mayor Lori Blong, Councilman Jack Ladd, and Councilwoman Amy Stretcher Burks, following their respective re-elections. Here's a rundown of what agenda items Reporter Telegram is watching. Water Well Maintenance Project. City Council will consider awarding a contract to Mark's Water Well Service for a maintenance project to both Paul Davis and T-Bar Well Fields. The company is one of two that submitted bids for the project. The details of the project are unclear, but it is stated that the annual budget is not to exceed $1 million annually. Road funding. City Council will look to appropriate $1 million from the 2017 Road Bond Fund for the Compass 06 program, a special infrastructure project account. The money collected from the fund will go toward anticipated roadway maintenance and infrastructure purposes related to Compass 06. Hazard Mitigation Action Plan. City Council seeks to adopt the Midland County 2025 Hazard Mitigation Action Plan, part of Year 2 of the plan's five-year cycle. According to the city, the plan identifies natural hazards affecting the area and outlines long-term strategies to reduce risks to people and property. Unfinished projects have the ability to be rolled into an updated version of the plan that would begin in 2030. Hotshots Review. City Council will review the 7-month incident report on hotshots that they originally filed when they granted the bar a specific use designation to sell alcohol on their premises. Based on their findings, they will have the ability to maintain peace officers on the premises due to reportedly high criminal activity on the block. Where competing bars, Double Bar Saloon and The Bar, are located. According to the report, there were 20 incidents reported at Hotshots from June through September 2025, compared to 25 at Double Bar and 10 at The Bar. Synergy SUD. After deferring a vote at the November meeting, City Council will again consider Synergy Entertainment's request to alter its already approved SUD with expanded hours for alcohol sales at the newly opened Synergy Tall City. Housing and Community Development Funds. City Council will look at possibly amending the city's 2025-26 action plan, specifically the section regarding housing and community development funds. City Council is encouraging public comment on the funds at the January 13th meeting. Drainage fees. After engaging in debate over an amendment to Title 11 of the Midland City Code, City Council will look at a revised version of the ordinance worked on by city staff. The debate had highlighted tensions between the city and MISD over the share of funds for road infrastructure projects following the omission of such projects from the MISD bond. And the hope is to finalize a version of the ordinance that will provide the least amount of financial repercussions for Midlanders and keep them more informed than they were back in December. If approved, the amendment will go into effect February 1st. Mayor pro tempore. City Council will appoint a council member, Mayor pro tempore, who will serve as mayor in an interim capacity in situations when Mayor Lori Blong is unable to fulfill her duties. Councilwoman-at-Large Robin Poole served in this capacity at the December meeting, and Councilman Jack Ladd has previously served in this role. Round 3 of MDC Board Interviews. City Council will hold a third round of interviews of applicants for the Midland Development Corporation Board. This article is entitled Legends and Lore. Midland Historian's new book traces Pecos River history by B.K. Richter, staff writer. James Collett realizes the importance of preserving history. The current president of the Midland County Historical Society, author, former public school teacher, and college professor, encourages people to document their own family stories and to appreciate the rich history of the region. Collett's last work, True Tales, Legends, and Lore of the Pecos River, chronicles the history of the Pecos River from prehistory to the present. During an interview with the Reporter-Telegram, he emphasized the importance of personal connections and his extensive research using archival records and historical newspapers to build upon the past. "I just think history is important, and we don't realize how important it is," he reflected. Collett, a native West Texan, said his inspiration behind the work came from growing up along the Pecos. "I grew up on the Pecos River, just south of here, in a little town called Sheffield," he explained. "I was thinking of something for the History Press, an imprint of Arcadia Publishing, and the History Press is more text-driven. So I thought it would be fun to do stories about the Texas Pecos River." That personal connection to the Pecos River shaped the project that became the basis for his historical work. "The more I thought about it, I thought about how this river has been part of my life," he recalled. "I like archaeology and prehistory. This river has been a part of my whole life, and my family goes back 3 generations. My great-grandparents were some of the early pioneers. I just realized my roots are deep in terms of that old river, and I just thought it would make an interesting story." The book's stories are both personal and were found through researching the historical archives located at Fort Stockton and Monahans. When you can, go to those actual places, because they're going to have stories that you can dig down a little deeper into than you used to, he said. I knew I wanted stories all along the river, so I tried to find places, and I also wanted to draw on the whole range of history. Collett said he drew upon his archaeological background to help build his work, but that he was also influenced by author Patrick Deeran, who is considered a recognized authority on the history of Pecos River country. A Midlander and former journalist at the Reporter-Telegram, Deeran has published several books about the Pecos River. And so I drew on that. But I didn't want to tread heavily in the same path Deeran did, Collett said. My book covers a much larger area than the earlier booklet. I think it's a matter of looking and trying to figure out all the different places to look. Part of it is just digging. Part of the fun of the research for me is going into an archive and not knowing what you are going to find. Collett interviewed locals and accessed old newspapers, which he said is much easier now given certain technological advances. One of his favorite stories is about his great-grandparents and how they came to purchase Sheffield Ranch, which the town was named for. They ran off to get married, and in a buggy, my grandfather went to Sherwood, which was a merchant area. And on the way there, my grandmother let him kiss her. And then she was afraid that he was going to put her out of the wagon for being such a loose woman, he explained. Another favorite story is a treasure hunt with a man who was a local mechanic in the area. He always imagined there were treasures all over, such as Spanish treasures, Collett recalled. He would go out and find some markings on a rock, and he was sure that was a sign. One day I got recruited to go with him, and he found these rocks, and he was sure a treasure was there. We dug this pit as deep as this desk, and we found nothing. But we were getting these metal detector readings like something was there, and it was an old homestead. We finally dig up this little metal horse and a few other pieces of metal. Collett has also written several photo-based books on Midland, Fort Stockton, and the old Spanish Trail Highway. He is currently working on a novel about a soldier at Fort Lancaster, and another discussing a descendant of Ira Griffith Yates. True Tales, Legends, and Lore of the Pecos River can be purchased online and from major booksellers. This article is entitled Licensing Agency Steps Up Fight Against Human Trafficking. TDLR is increasing its focus on regulated professions. By Kesley Salinas, staff writer. January is Human Trafficking Prevention Month, and the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation is helping fight human trafficking in its regulated professions. TDLR said its employees are firmly part of the fight against coerced labor or commercial sex acts. According to TDLR, several of the regulated programs can have a nexus with potential human trafficking, and TDLR employees and licensees can work together to identify and eliminate human trafficking in these programs. TDLR regulates massage therapists, massage establishments, cosmetologists, nail salons, and many other professions where trafficking may be present. TDLR said its employees and licensees can be the first ally in contact with potential human trafficking victims. According to TDLR, its health professions licensees may interact with trafficked people if they are brought in for medical assistance. Beauty licensees may interact with trafficked people if their traffickers want to alter or control the appearance of the individual to make them more attractive to potential clients. TDLR said it conducts periodic, unannounced inspections of massage establishments and cosmetology salons and aggressively pursues administrative penalties for both licensed and unlicensed service providers, found to allow sexual activity on business premises. TDLR employees who routinely interact with licensees receive training on how to recognize and respond to human trafficking conditions. Agency employees work with local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies, as well as non-governmental agencies, to investigate suspected illicit massage businesses and possible human trafficking at nail salons. As part of the department's fight against human trafficking in Texas, TDLR issued 51 emergency orders that ultimately permanently revoked the licenses of 63 Texas massage establishments suspected of human trafficking during the first 2 years of Texas House Bill 3579, which was passed in the 88th legislative regular session. Before they can renew their licenses, many TDLR licensees are required to complete an approved human trafficking prevention training course on how to spot human trafficking. This includes the following: 400,000 cosmetologists and barbers, more than 83,000 health professions practitioners, including massage therapists, athletic trainers, audiologists, behavior analysts, dietitians, dyslexia therapists, hearing instrument fitters and dispensers, midwives, orthotists, prosthetists, podiatrists, and speech-language pathologists. Anyone who suspects human trafficking is occurring can contact the National Hotline for Human Trafficking at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to Be Free at 233-733. If the situation is an emergency or you believe someone is in immediate danger, call 911 and alert the authorities. Anyone who suspects human trafficking in a TDLR-regulated business can also file a complaint with TDLR. This article is entitled, "Locals Line Up at Stanton's Hospital for Smashburgers," by Kesley Salinas, staff writer. Stanton. The best smashburger in West Texas isn't coming off a trendy food truck or out of a neon-lit diner. It's being pressed, seared, and served inside Martin County Hospital, where Bistro 20 has quickly become a stop for hungry customers from across the Permian Basin. Under the leadership of Chef Maxwell Warner, Bistro 20 has become Stanton's hidden gem, featuring a flavorful menu that many don't expect in a hospital setting. When I came in, I really wanted to change the mission from having your typical hospital food and elevate it with fresh products and different cooking methods, Warner told the reporter Telegram. We've really hit a home run with it in terms of people enjoying it. Warner said Bistro 20 had seen customers commuting from Midland, Big Spring, Andrews, and other surrounding towns. They've heard of us by word of mouth, and they've come and tried us, Warner said. We have regular customers that return every day. Since Warner's arrival, traffic has increased by about 70% year over year, with continued growth projected in 2026. Jason Menifee, chief operating officer for the Martin County Hospital District, said many vendors and consultants have also left positive reviews of the cafe. They'll make comments like, "I can't wait to do some work at Martin County because we get to have lunch and dinner or breakfast there," Menifee said. It's really neat to have vendors and consultants that are in this industry tell us that we have something special. The cafe doesn't use frozen, canned, or pre-made things, and instead incorporates fresh ingredients while keeping the menu affordable. The menu features what many call the best smashburger in West Texas, which is made with locally sourced American Wagyu beef from Stanton's HQ land and livestock, Warner said. The flavor is just incredible. And that's why we claim to have the best burger in West Texas, Warner said. It's the most popular thing on our menu, and it's kind of become what we're known for. Bistro 20 features a weekly menu that can include dishes such as freshly sliced prime rib, grilled swordfish, crusted Atlantic salmon, New York strip with truffle mushroom sauce, chicken pot pies, chicken fried steak, catfish, Tex-Mex, and more. While a hospital cafe isn't what one might typically think of as a destination to find tasty meals, each day at lunchtime, a line forms outside the door. Warner said Bistro 20 serves about 150 to 200 people for lunch daily. Including breakfast, the cafe serves about 400 to 450 people. We have two very small windows of operation, so it's not like your traditional restaurant where we're open all day, Warner said. So to do it all in about 2.5 hours is pretty cool. Menifee added that although a line forms outside the door, customers don't wait long to get their food. One thing that we've been successful with is the volume of meals we can serve during that lunch hour, Menifee said. In fact, during Thanksgiving, we served almost 600 meals over a 2-hour period. Cafe customers aren't just patients and hospital visitors. Bistro 20 gets customers from around Stanton, oilfield workers, construction workers, business workers, and high school students and teachers. We have people rave about the quality of food they're getting, and we get repeat customers, Warner said. Menifee said the cafe has also received great satisfaction from inpatients. We have anywhere from 1 to sometimes 8 or 9 inpatients, and their dietary plan requires very controlled meals, Menifee said. Those patients get surveyed on quality and satisfaction, and we've been above the 90th percentile compared to other hospitals our size. With the bistro ramping up, the patient quality has come up with those meals as well. Warner said this is possible because he has implemented the same philosophy of using fresh meat, fresh vegetables, and ingredients into the patient side of operations as well. We have tried to change as much as we can to adhere to our vision, and we make everything from scratch, Warner said. Luckily, here in Martin County, they line up with the vision I was going for. They want excellence in healthcare and want their patients to receive the best nutrition possible. He added that food is also medicine, because receiving high-quality food and good nutrition is important to the healing process. Those diets are just as important as the treatment they're receiving from their doctor, Warner said. The menu. The biggest hit on the menu is the Smash Burger, which has 2 4-ounce American Wagyu patties, caramelized onions, brioche sesame buns, and a secret sauce. Another customer favorite is the Tex-Mex. Bistro 20's a la carte menu recently featured the Big Brisket Grinder, which is smoked brisket with Tony Daniels barbecue, sharp cheddar, pickled onions, and raspberry habanero jam on the Denver Crunch. The King of Clubs is a club sandwich with applewood smoked turkey, thick-cut bacon, Swiss and cheddar cheese, alfalfa sprouts, mixed greens, tomatoes, shaved onion, Kewpie mayo, and Dijon mustard on triple whole wheat. The menu also included pecan-crusted chicken fingers, All Hail Caesar, chicken Caesar salad in a pita pocket, and a foot-long corn dog. The cafe's weekly menu can be found on the Martin County Hospital District's social media pages. The cafe is located on the first floor, west of the lobby. According to the Martin County Hospital's website, the cafeteria is open to the public for breakfast from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and for lunch from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. This article is entitled Man Pleads Guilty to Assault Weapon Charge by Trevor Hawes, editor. A man has been sentenced to 1.5 years behind bars after pleading guilty to aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Robert Frank Rangel Jr. was arrested October 6, 2023, after exhibiting a gun while threatening a woman with bodily injury, according to court documents. Rangel has had several previous run-ins with the law in Midland County, including felony convictions for burglary of a habitation in 2018 and tampering with physical evidence in 2021. On January 8th, Rangel pleaded guilty to aggravated assault with a deadly weapon in the 142nd District Court of the Honorable David G. Rogers. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison, and his sentence is to run concurrently with his federal sentence. Rangel pleaded guilty December 28, 2023, to possession of a firearm by a convicted felon in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Texas before the Honorable David Counts. He was sentenced to 63 months in prison and was ordered to turn over his Ruger 9mm pistol to the federal government. Rangel also faced a charge of continuous violence against family stemming from a May 2023 incident. However, this case was dismissed on January 8th upon his guilty plea for aggravated assault. This article is entitled, Man Who Sped 111 Miles Per Hour on the Highway Gets Prison for DWI, by Trevor Hawes, editor. A man has been sentenced to prison after pleading guilty to his third offense of driving while intoxicated. On July 19, 2025, Rockley Vaughn Rico was arrested in Midland after he was found to be driving upward of 111 miles per hour on State Highway 191, according to a previous Reporter Telegram report. After Department of Public Safety troopers pulled his vehicle over, Rico was said to have slurred speech, glassy eyes, and smelled like alcohol. Upon running his information, troopers found Rico had a suspended driver's license and had two previous convictions for driving while intoxicated. He was also found to be wanted on a warrant in Hidalgo County for assault of a pregnant person, a third-degree felony. Rico was arrested and charged with a third or more offense of driving while intoxicated, a third-degree felony. He was also charged with a pair of misdemeanors. Court records show Rico was convicted in Hidalgo County of DWI in 2019 and 2024, as well as assault of a public servant in 2019. On January 8th, Rico pleaded guilty to third or more DWI in the 385th District Court of the Honorable Leah G. Robertson. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison. This article is entitled, Midland's Job Market Held Steady Amid Some Uncertainty. But the area no longer has the lowest unemployment rate in the state. By Mella McEwen, Oil Editor. Midland's job market held steady in November amid economic uncertainty in the area's dominant mining, logging, and construction sector, though it no longer has the state's lowest unemployment rate. The Texas Workforce Commission reported the November unemployment rate in its Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, which includes Midland and Martin counties, was 3.2% in November, up from 3% in November 2024. The commission did not release October data due to the federal government shutdown. Midland reported the second lowest unemployment statewide, just behind Amarillo's 3.1%. Odessa had an unemployment rate of 3.8%, up from 3.6% in November 2024. Our offices aren't seeing heavy layoffs, said Willie Taylor, chief executive officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions Permian Basin, told the Reporter Telegram. Look at the infrastructure. Highway 191, Highway 80, Interstate 20. Traffic is really heavy there. He also predicted continued construction jobs as Midland's two new high schools get underway and road construction continues. In talking with advisory board members, Taylor said he emphasizes the need to discuss the impact of artificial intelligence on the workforce. He said he also continues to urge residents to upgrade their skills, and go through training so they can earn higher wages. I hope, if anything, this year we'll see employment numbers steady, he said. Midland's civilian labor force grew to 106,616 from 104,660 the previous November. The number of employed Midlanders also grew to 103,227 from 101,507, while the number of unemployed Midlanders also rose to 3,389 from 3,153 a year earlier. Midland reported 127,400 non-farm jobs in November, up 200 from October's 120,200. The trade, transportation, and utilities sector added 200 jobs. The professional and business services sector, private education and health services sector, and government sector each added 100 jobs. Mining, logging, and construction was the only sector to lose jobs, shedding 300 during the month. For the 12 months from November 2024 to November 2025, Midland added 1,100 jobs, for a growth rate of 0.9. Trade, transportation, and utilities grew by 400 jobs, followed by leisure and hospitality with 300 new jobs. The professional and business services sector and the private education and health services sector each gained 200 jobs. Financial activities and the government sector each added 100 jobs. Mining, logging, and construction was the only sector to lose jobs, losing 200 jobs during the year. Statewide, the unemployment rate was 4.2%. The state added 7,300 non-farm jobs in November to total 14,321,000 positions. Over the year, the state added 146,300 jobs. Texas's civilian labor force reached a new record high of 15,938,500 after adding 59,500 people since September. While Amarillo had the lowest rate, the highest was in Eagle Pass at 8.3%. This article is entitled, Officials Urge Home Tests for Cancer-Causing Radon Gas, by B. K. Richter, staff writer. The month of January is National Radon Action Month, and the Texas Department of State Health Services remind Texans of the dangers of the naturally occurring cancer-causing radioactive gas. You can't see, smell, or taste radon, DSHS said in a statement. However, if inhaled, it can damage DNA and cause lung cancer. According to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, is the leading cause of lung cancer deaths among non-smokers within the U.S. Radon exposures cause about 21,000 Americans to die each year, said DSHS. Prevention starts with testing for radon in your home. And if a high radon level is detected within one's home, one can take steps to fix the issue. According to Kaylee Millerick, an associate professor of civil, environmental, and construction engineering at Texas Tech University, radon can enter a home by migrating through permeable rocks and soils, eventually seeping into buildings or releasing into the atmosphere. Radon is related to geology, she told the Reporter Telegram, and so there are certain geological formations that contain a mineral called uranyl. Uranio is actually uranium-based, but not from a radioactive perspective. This is not fuel-grade uranium. This is just a naturally occurring mineral that's honestly found across the country in various contexts. Millerick said that what happens as the uranium breaks down is that it forms another chemical called radium. Radium is also mineral-based, she explained. Typically, it is tens of feet under the surface, and so you never come in contact with it. But the second decay product is radon, which is a gas. And so what happens is something that's naturally occurring in the soil that no one ever comes in contact with because it's 20 feet under the ground, or however far down it is in the grass, goes through just a natural decay processes. And one of those decay products is a gas. And that's when it moves, because it breaks down further after that. The issue is that when it becomes a gas, it is able to seep through the soil and into the air. And typically, one wouldn't notice it while located outside. There's zero risk to it outside, she said. Except when it gets into a confined space, it can accumulate. And that's when it becomes a risk from a lung cancer perspective. As far as the risk in Texas, Millerick said there are really only two main areas that have a higher than usual concentration of uranium: the Texas Panhandle and an area due west of Austin. The area that is west of Austin tends to be a ranching area where there aren't a lot of homes, Millerick said. We do see more homes within the stretch that's in the Panhandle. When measuring the levels of radon and determining if the levels are unsafe, radon is measured in units of picocuries per liter. The frustrating part of radon is that the only measurements that we can use are inside a property, and it's difficult for me to compare radon concentrations inside, say, a school, to radon concentrations inside a house, Millerick explained. Part of the reason for that variation is that the air exchange inside a school is different due to multiple HVAC systems. They also have multiple doors going in and out, so in general you're going to see lower concentrations inside of a school just because there's so much air exchange. And this is a gap. And so my mapping efforts are exclusive to private residences. While Millerick said that the data between schools and apartments is similar due to multiple HVAC systems. Apartment complexes tend to have multiple HVAC systems, so there's a higher flow of air. The other thing is, because it concentrates in spaces that are closest to the ground, typically, you will see decreases in concentrations by approximately a factor of 4 as you go up in stories, Millerick said. So, a basement concentration is going to be 4 times higher than a first floor concentration, which tends to be 4 times higher than a second story concentration. I don't think I have had a single case of radon above level 4 for the second story or above. I only see it in the first floor and basements. Once radon tracking efforts are made, Millerick explained that there are more than 20,000 data points across the state of Texas, at which point detection efforts can be made to help determine risks with unsafe levels. It's done by people actually taking tests inside their homes, and I provide those tests for free. So anybody who emails me to submit a form on my website, it takes us a couple of weeks to turn them around right now, but if you send me a test or if you send me an inquiry, I will send you a radon test. Millerick said that while those data points are tracked on her website, they do not reveal specific home data. I don't publish GIS points for any of the radon hits that I receive, she said. It is important to note that while there is an absence of radon certification requirements within the state, the National Radon Proficiency Program does list radon testers and mitigators within Texas who have complied with a national certification program. This article is entitled, Permian Resources Says It's Focused on Revitalizing Downtown Midland, by Mella McEwen, oil editor. Permian Resources is working to revitalize its downtown neighborhood. Growing downtown businesses is part of its focus on community enhancement and quality of life. As part of that focus, Permian Resources reached a deal to bring a new restaurant, Georgie's Place, to its building at 300 North Marienfeld. When it opens at the end of the month, the restaurant will join Far Out West Coffee in serving the public. Beyond those efforts, the community is putting money behind its community involvement. While most efforts are focused on Midland, the company also supports nonprofits in other communities where it operates. Johnny Hines, Vice President of Corporate Affairs, said the company's budget for charitable giving has soared 367% in 2 years. From a budget of $750,000 in 2023, he said $3.6 million was given in 2025. Lindsay White, Community Engagement Advisor, said the company focuses on three areas in its charitable work: child advocacy, community enhancement, and an employee commitment in which it matches dollar-for-dollar employee donations. Almost $200,000 was raised this way. The company held 10 different volunteer events last year, including 4 food drives and 3 Christmas drives, White said. Heinz came to Permian Resources from Concho Resources, which was known for its community involvement. Permian Resources founders James Walter and Will Hickey have said on a number of occasions Diamondback Energy was a role model for their community involvement. Permian Resources is also a sponsor of the Midland Athletic Syndicate, which is building a 115,000-square-foot indoor sports complex at Scarborough Sports Complex. The company is also a supporter of the Northwest YMCA and Children's Rehabilitation Clinic. "Our goal is quality of life and opportunities for kids to get involved," said White, adding that she meets regularly with local nonprofits, estimating she has met with more than 60, and is impressed with their commitment to Midland. Heinz noted that the company also has a charitable giving committee of employees who discuss opportunities. The company helps connect employees with nonprofits so they can either volunteer or serve on nonprofit boards. This article is entitled "Principal Training Program Gets Nearly $5 Million." PSP, Scarborough Foundation, put up funding for future school leaders. By Kesley Salinas, staff writer. The Holdsworth Center has received nearly $5 million in grant funding for its Aspiring Principals program, which will help build future school leaders in the Permian Basin. The Permian Strategic Partnership put in $2.7 million, while the Scarborough Foundation added $2.1 million. The Stillwater Foundation contributed $100,000. The Aspiring Principals program is an intensive year-long leadership development experience designed to prepare outstanding educators to take the helm as principals. Principals are hugely important when it comes to influencing student outcomes, PSP CEO Tracy Bentley said. When our districts told us they needed more support to develop outstanding school leaders, we listened. We feel confident this investment is going to create stronger schools for our Permian communities. Through the generosity of these companies, the Aspiring Principals program has now been expanded to include educators from Ector County ISD, Pecos Barstow Toya ISD, and the surrounding areas. It's no secret that school districts are struggling to find enough leaders ready to fill these critically important roles, especially in remote areas like ours, said Keeley Boyer, superintendent of ECISD. We are so excited and grateful for this generous investment in our amazing educators. Holdsworth training is world-class. This will be a game-changer for Permian communities. Over the next 2 to 3 years, the funding will support up to 100 future school leaders in 42 districts in West Texas and Southeast New Mexico. Serving as a principal is deeply rewarding, yet it comes with real challenges, said Mary Ann Beninati, president and CEO of the Scarborough Foundation. The Permian is fortunate to have hundreds of dedicated educators, and it's essential that we equip them for success through strong preparation and the confidence that comes from seeing great leadership in action. We are proud to support this groundbreaking initiative. The Aspiring Principals Program. The Aspiring Principals program launched in the summer with 27 aspiring principals, marking the first cohort of the program in the Permian Basin. The program builds on-the-job learning through real principal-level stretch projects, offers personalized coaching from seasoned school leaders, and pairs each aspiring leader with high-performing principals from across the state to shadow during rotation field visits. Sharon Foley, Managing Director of Campus Programs at the Holzwell Center, said that aspiring principals have been learning about instructional leadership and how they can support strong teaching and student learning. She added that the cohort has been preparing for their upcoming rotations, where they get to visit campuses of excellent principals across the state of Texas and observe them in action. "The content was some of the most impactful professional learning I've experienced," said Amber Godby, an aspiring principal in Pecos Barstow Toya ISD. "Every session was grounded in real leadership practice with a perfect balance of reflection, skill building, and application." Future school leaders. Aspiring principals can now apply to the program with the Holzwell Center to join the next cohort, which will accept 36 educators. The application is open to educators who are seeking to become a principal within 1 to 3 years. Foley said that individuals with a growth mindset and those who are excited to build strong relationships with their team make great candidates for the program. "At the Holzwell Center, we believe that leadership is a skill that can be taught," Foley said. "You're not born with it. And we believe that if you have a growth mindset and are open to learning, you can build a ton of skill around leadership." The Aspiring Principals program is a year long and includes 6 learning sessions. 2 of the summer sessions are held in Austin, but the other 4 sessions are held in Odessa. The program also includes executive coaching and 3 rotations, where aspiring principals visit campuses to meet with and observe proven leaders from across the state. The program is also completely free for aspiring principals, thanks to the grant funding the Holzwell Center has received, Foley said. "We're so grateful to the Permian Strategic Partnership and to the Scarborough Foundation for putting financial resources behind this program, so that our leaders can engage in this opportunity free of cost to them," Foley said. "Leadership development is an important investment, and it can be challenging for leaders to find the funds on their own. So we're super grateful."
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.